Hello and welcome to the Pathways interview program, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. In a world of growing traffic congestion, expensive oil, and threats of cataclysmic climate change, a grassroots movement is carving out a niche for bicycles on the streets of urban cityscapes. These days, bicycle riding has become a political statement and a policy issue. Our guest today on Pathways explores the growing urban bike culture that is changing the look and feel of cities across the United States and how urban bike activists are creating the future of how we travel and live. Today we are visiting with Jeff Mapes, author of the new book, Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities, which came out in 2009, was a bestseller for the Oregon State University Press, and was reviewed in the New York Times. Jeff is also the senior political reporter at the Oregonian newspaper in Portland and is the author of the blog Mapes on Politics. He's also a regular political analyst on Oregon Public Broadcasting. He lives with his wife Karen in Portland. Their last transportation purchase was a cargo bike. Hello, Jeff, and welcome to Pathways.
Yeah, good morning. It's great to be here.
Now, as I just said, you've been a political reporter for decades at the Oregonian. How did you come to be a spokesman for urban cycling and the author of this book, Pedaling Revolution?
Yeah, it is kind of a funny switch. Really, it started because I started being out there in the street and pedaling. I mean, I've always loved to cycle, but like a lot of people, when I was a kid, I cycled all over the city where I grew up, Oakland, California. But like a lot of people, once I got out of high school, went to college, got a job, started a family and a career, I didn't think a great deal about bicycling. Had a busy life. Reporters drive a lot as a rule. But about 15 years or so ago, I got tired of taking the bus downtown to work, and I thought, you know, let me see what it feels like to ride to work. So I'd start doing it on nice days, started doing it, pretty soon I was to the point where, gee, it's raining kind of lightly, I can just throw on a jacket and I'll be okay. And the more I did it, the more I really enjoyed it. I'd been on this plan where I was gaining a pound or so every year, from the time I left college, pretty ordinary pattern among people, and that kind of stopped. I stopped gaining weight, felt better, more alert when I got into the office, felt better when I came home. And at the same time I was doing this, it was very interesting. The city of Portland had started really doing a real deliberate effort to create a bikeway network around the city of bike lanes, bike paths, that sort of thing. And as I started going on my my commute, I found that it started to get easier, not only because I was getting more adept at it, but because the city was making it easier. For example, it used to be going across the Broadway Bridge, you'd go across this kind of slick wooden deck where pedestrians walked on one side of it, and when you got to the west end of the Broadway Bridge, it was kind of tricky. You had to kind of go left to go down Broadway and make sure you didn't get a car hit you going to the right to go down the Lovejoy viaduct. And then one day the city came in and put in a light, special light just for cyclists, so that danger was eliminated. They put in a bike lane along Broadway. So I started getting curious about, gee, who's really doing this? What's the intention here? Is this happening in other cities? And I started looking around and found that yes, there is kind of this this movement, very grassroots oriented, that is growing. And the more I looked into it, the more I decided, this is something worth writing about.
I'm amazed that there are so many cyclists in Portland. What do you attribute that to? And these changes that the city made, were they to accommodate all these cyclists, or was it the other way around? Did the cycling become much more popular because of the changes that the administration was making?
It's interesting. It is a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. There is no doubt that Portland appeals to a lot of people who tend to be cyclists. We're a very outdoor-oriented city. And so I think for a long time, there's always been a large group of cyclists here, relatively speaking.
But the weather sort of mitigates it.
You know, actually, that's the interesting thing. People think, oh, you know, the great place for cycling is a real warm weather city. But actually, you'll find in cities around the world that this almost seems to be the sweet spot for bicycling. Two of the best bike cities in the world are Copenhagen and Amsterdam. And those are both very similar climates, you know, kind of marine influenced, rainy, but somewhat temperate, you know, not real, doesn't get real super cold in the winter. And the summers are a little milder, you know. I mean, you know, cycling in 100 degree weather with 100 degree humidity can get somewhat unpleasant. So actually that, this, in many ways, Portland is the archetype of a
but
successful
is it rain?
Bicycling.
I mean, is it rain makes cycling a real drag?
You know, once you get used to it, I don't find it too much of a bother. I mean, I don't like it when it's really raining hard, but, you know, usually in Portland we kind of have that kind of misty rain. And
yeah.
Half the time, you know, when it's raining hard outside, I kind of shrug and say, well, maybe I'll wait another 10 minutes. And, you know, half the time it's gone by the time I actually do get out there. I'm surprised often how little I get rained on, although this year has maybe been a little bit of an exception to that. But getting back to your original question, so I think there was a lot of interest. I think the things that the city did in creating more of a bikeway network also encouraged people to ride more often. And frankly, the more people you get out on the street, the more it feeds on it. The more people see other people doing it, the more they feel empowered to do it themselves. And in fact, it makes cycling safer because there really is a lot of evidence that there is safety in numbers, that the more people out doing an activity like cycling, and it makes sense, the more motorists will be looking out for you.
Now, I really enjoyed your book, and in your book you talk about a few other places in the United States where significant developments are taking place in bicycling culture in cities. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, there are several cities, and they really kind of range from, I guess I'd almost put them in two categories. One are smaller university towns, where in some ways the bicycling culture never really went away, has been strong. Cities like Davis, California, Boulder, Colorado, Madison, Wisconsin are real good examples of that. And you have a lot of students, you know, campuses are really ideal for bicycles. You've got large spaces, you know, often with very little traffic. Students, you know, don't always have access to cars. It's a convenient way to get around. And then the second thing I'd say would be in larger cities where increasingly people discover once they start biking, it's actually easier to bicycle so many places in cities than almost any other mode in transportation. In about a 2 or 3 mile radius, I'll pretty much stack up my speed on the bicycle in Portland to a car, particularly, you know, all the trouble of finding a parking place for your car and all that sort of thing. So increasingly in a lot of cities, people are finding it a very sensible, quick alternative. And you see very, very vibrant bike cultures in not only in Portland, but in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Minneapolis, cities that have a certain density and a certain kind of probably progressive culture, I would say, that allows for that.
You know, it just makes so much sense at a place like New York when half, where most of the residents of Manhattan don't own a car anyway.
Right.
And why would you create a system where, you know, you give such preferential treatment to taxis speeding around and not make it safer for bicycles? Can you tell us a little bit about the New York story?
Yeah, New York is fascinating. I spent a lot of time there, and, you know, people have for decades really realized that New York would be an ideal bike city because of its density. It's flat. You can get places so quickly. You know, I had to laugh. There were two very famous authors who ran for mayor back in the 1960s. One a real conservative, William F. Buckley. One on the political left, Norman Mailer. And they're kind of somewhat joke candidacies, but they actually ran very vigorous campaigns. And the one thing that both of them had in common was that they said, you know, there should be more bike boulevards in New York because it's a great way to get around town. So people have been thinking about this for a long time. And in recent years, the city under a new transportation commissioner, Jeanette Sadek Khan, who's really a pathbreaker in this area, and you know, during the Bloomberg administration, has really aggressively pushed to create more bike lanes and also more European-style bike lanes called cycle tracks, where they're really separate. They have a separation from the traffic, where you have the curb, then the bicycles, and then parked cars, and then the motorized vehicles. So they're really, you know, they have a much safer feel to them. They're starting to put these types of lanes around Manhattan and also some of the other boroughs, getting big increases in ridership. And to the point now where they're starting to get some political pushback because, you know, it's change, and that's always difficult. I just today, as a matter of fact, saw a cartoon that was in the New York Daily News, and it showed Bloomberg out with a snowblower clearing the streets, only he was clearing the bike lanes first while cars were still buried in snow, and it showed cyclists falling behind saying, best mayor, one of them saying best mayor ever. And I think the cartoon was meant to be derogatory, but
well, most things in the Daily News are
right. Well, you know, it's as a political reporter, if you have a movement and it's not getting pushback, then it's probably not doing very much.
That's an interesting point of view. Now, the percentage of bicycle commuters is still low, even in places like Portland, where it's probably higher than anywhere else in the country.
Among large cities, yes.
Yeah, among the large cities, yeah. Do you think that bicycling has any chance of ever becoming a mainstream transportation choice?
Well, that's a real interesting question, and I guess part of it is what you define as mainstream. I mean, in Portland now, roughly, we'll have 6-8% of residents who commute to work by bicycle. That obviously varies depending on the time of year. There's an interesting survey the city does that I think shows something like another 10-15% of people regard bicycling as a secondary form of transportation. So, you know, they do use it for some forms of transportation. Now, that actually gets to a point where it's not it's somewhat competitive with mass transit, where I think 11% regard it as a primary form of transportation. So you're really, in a city like Portland, getting not insignificant numbers. Now, the big question is, can you get to the kind of numbers that you see in an Amsterdam and a Copenhagen, where 25 to 30 plus of the population are out there riding every day, and where it's just very, very clearly a mainstream transportation choice. And I think that's still something to be seen. I mean, I think it has to become a lot safer. People have to feel that it's certainly a safer choice. There probably will have to be further structural accommodations that would have to be made for this to happen. And it starts to get into more money. A lot of what cities have done so far of, you know, for example, your typical bike lane that you see in this country, you know, that's basically just paint. It's not terribly expensive to do. When you start doing more of the separated kind of cycle tracks that I was talking about in New York, that takes more space, it takes more expense, and that's going to be a harder sell politically. One of the things, though, that I think is a major factor that may really encourage, well, there's several things that may encourage this, but one thing that I think is very important is the whole health aspect. You know, as I think you probably explored a lot in this show, you know, we have a real obesity crisis in this country, and people need, particularly in sort of the sedentary society we live in, they really need outlets for physical activity on a daily basis, and this is one way to provide that. So I think there's that, and when you put in the environmental factors you mentioned earlier, the rising price of oil, congestion, all that, I think there's a lot of factors that point toward increasing use of bicycling.
What most commonly motivates adults to take up bicycle riding? Like commuting to work, let's say.
Right, right. Well, I think, there's a certain... Probably the core ridership are people who are really avid cyclists. They do it for recreation, for sport, and this becomes an extension of that. You know, sometimes my boss looks at me a little funny when I come into work riding on a bad day, and I'll say to him, well, if you could golf your way to work, would you? You know, and that kind of clicked with him, and I think he sort of got it when I put it in those terms.
So that motivation is you like riding.
Right,
you
exactly. You just love it so much that this is another opportunity. And in the same way that, hey, if I could play a couple holes of golf on my way to work, I'd do that too. If you're a golfer, at any rate.
Yeah, I think maybe they're equally frustrating for different reasons.
Yes.
At least on the golf course, nobody's going to run over you with a golf cart.
That's right. Although sometimes these golfers get a little upset. I really do think the second one is health. I mean, I think people find, you know, in the busy lives that we all have, I know when I started riding, I still had young kids at home at the time, demanding job. And if I could get, 45 minutes to an hour of exercise every day and actually spend less time commuting than I was spending on the bus, boy, talk about a win-win. And you know, by feeling better physically, that made a huge difference. And now it really is my main form of physical activity. I ride around town as much as I can, and the more I do it, the better I feel, you know, and you start getting up to my age, that matters.
You know, I've taken up biking to a greater extent, but I still don't ride in the rain. And one of the reasons one of the things that motivated me was I'm an environmentalist. In fact, the only car I have is a Prius. Mm-hmm. For the same reason. But then somebody said to me, well, bicycles aren't really that green. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, not only is there the manufacturer of the bicycles and the tires, etc., but you it takes extra calories. In other words, you have to eat more.
Well, but here's the thing. Let's be honest about this. You know, I am not starved for calories here. I've got what I call my strategic calorie reserve.
Yeah.
And
that's
you
good.
Now, you know, that may well be true if you are somebody who's really, you know, in peak of physical condition and riding, you know, 20 or 30 miles to work. And you are consuming more calories. What I find, and you know, they say that, you know, the health experts will tell you this, that most people who get, you know, half an hour to an hour and a half of exercise a day, they eat about as much as they would if they were sedentary. And the difference is you're not, you're not storing it away. You're burning that off.
Now, the promotion of bicycling has become a political movement at this point. And your book addresses that. How did that happen?
Well, wait a minute. I'm not sure I quite understood that.
How did it become a political movement?
Oh, right. Well, I think, you know, in essence, probably everything in society is political to some degree whenever you're really talking about change. I mean, I think the thing that cycling advocates really realized is that they need to get resources to grow this movement. I mean, they look at cities once again like Amsterdam or Copenhagen, and what they see there is that investments are made in those cities, and that those determine what those cities are going to be like, what those transportation choices are going to be like. I think one way that we don't quite understand in America is that however we spend our money on transportation, that's social engineering. When you decide to build a freeway to a location, I mean, then you're affecting what communities grow, what don't. You're affecting, how far people live from work. I mean, all of that has an impact on the way we live. And so I think very much advocates looked at that if they were going to grow this movement and create the kind of cities that they wanted to see created, then they needed to get a share of those resources to create the kind of infrastructure they wanted.
You know, there's so many interesting facts in your book that I didn't know before. Like, for instance, the average working class family spends more on transportation than on rent. I found that amazing. And then if everyone cycled for an hour each day and reduced their driving by an equivalent distance, we would reduce auto gas consumption by 38%.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Now think about that. I mean, and even the guy who did that statistic will admit that you're not going to have that happen. I mean, not everybody drives an hour a day. Not everybody is capable of substituting the, you know, an hour that they drive each day for riding. And it doesn't mean that you have to ride the same distance as you would drive. Just, you know, if you could reduce the time you spent in your car by that amount and substitute it for riding. But it's a useful thought experiment. It does tell you that if you make a major shift, once again, as some countries have done, then you can have a real impact. And even in this country, you know, something like 40% of trips are 2 miles or less, I believe, and two-thirds of those are by automobile now. And if you can shift a significant percentage of those trips to bicycling or walking, then, you know, you can start to make a real dent in consumption. And I'd say one other thing about this, and I think it's an important point to make, is don't be disparaging of relatively small drops, say, for example, in the consumption of oil. You know, during the recession that we've been going through, our mileage driven has dropped a little bit, really kind of the first time in ages that's happened, that our vehicle miles driven has dropped. And that's helped tamp down the price of oil. Remember, before the recession, it was spiking up there at $4 or $5 a gallon, and now as the economy starts to recover, it's starting to go back up. But really, relatively small reductions in consumption can actually have a big impact on the price of oil.
But what about the vast populations of Americans who live in suburbs, which were designed around the myth of a unlimited petroleum future?
Right, and that that is a real big question, you know, because you don't, you know, I very deliberately in my book in the subtitle talked about American cities, and because it really is largely an urban phenomenon that you're seeing. There are some suburbs that are starting to do some things. Arlington, Virginia is a good example of that. There are several things you can do in the suburbs. I mean, they have more ability to put in trails there, both for recreation and transportation. If you can start building more links between subdivisions, but the distances are greater, and you know, it's harder to have to walk and cycle to locations there, and so that's going to be tougher.
What kinds of new problems does mass bicycling produce in a city, and what's the best way to integrate cars and bikes? Because I guess your book points out there's two kind of separate approaches. One of them is treat bicycles like cars. Then there's have a second road system, like you were talking about in Amsterdam, and other kinds of special facilities. What do you think is the best way to go?
Yeah. Well, I think if you're going to have large numbers of cyclists, you do have to have a bikeway system. I mean, the vehicular cyclists who basically say, you know, operate as much as possible like a motor vehicle, and vehicular cycling does work, and for people who get good at it, they can ride in pretty, what would to a lot of people would find pretty daunting traffic. But once again, to have something that's going to attract large numbers of people, I think you are going to need to make cycling very convenient, safe, and I think you are going to have, I wouldn't call it a separate roadway system. What I would say is that on busier streets, you have accommodations for cyclists, you know, cycle paths, whatever, and then you do a lot of speed reduction in neighborhoods, and that's really what cities like Amsterdam and Copenhagen are doing. Is really on the cyclists and drivers share the roads on quieter streets, but that you really bring down the speeds on those streets.
Now, what do you say to motorists who are irritated at bicyclists who blow through stoplights and break other traffic laws?
Yeah, and that is a legitimate thing because, you know, you have a lot of cyclists out there that are sort of learning by doing, watching what others do. There's, you know, we don't have any sort of formal training as motorists do, you know, and we had a certain kind of culture based on, you know, motorists sort of having the streets solely to themselves. And, you know, even among motorists, it's considered okay to violate some laws. I mean, hardly anybody seems to follow the speed limit going down I-5. And so when you introduce into that mix cyclists, then there are, it is difficult to accommodate for that. I think a lot of that will be taken care of by time. I think one thing I've found in this city that that cyclists, for example, a larger percentage are now obeying stoplights, at least, and so I think the culture can change in that way. So I think it's really just, I guess the main thing I would say is be patient.
And what about kids? I mean, are kids starting to ride their bikes again?
A little bit. You're starting to see some of that come back, and you know, there's an elementary school not far from my house in Northeast Portland. You know, and there's lots of adult cyclists in my neighborhood now, and you see a lot of kids being cycled to school by their parents. Either, you know, the parents doing it with their kids next to them on their bike, or maybe they're riding on the back of their bike, you know, with a trailer bike or something like that. And so you're starting to see some of that movement, and as it becomes more of a mainstream choice for adults, then I think it will be for kids too.
Yeah. And what was your hope in writing this book, The Pedaling Revolution? And are you writing more about bicycling in the future?
Yeah, I do continue to write about bicycling. I do some magazine writing about it. I just wrote a couple chapters for a book. You know, it's a compilation of articles, of chapters written by different people. So I am continuing to do that. I still have a great interest in the subject. You know, I think, you know, like any journalist, I really just wanted to describe this fascinating movement that I saw, and I just didn't really see anything written about it that I thought in the same way attempted to sort of explain this to the average reader.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff, we've just about run out of time. Is there anything that you'd like to close with, or tell people how to find out more information?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that is fascinating is that I think one thing that's been important for the growth of this movement has been the internet, because so much of this has been a relatively small number of people kind of scattered around the country, and I do think that the internet is a great source of information about this, and hopefully I hope people will take a look at my book too.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope they do too, because it was really a lot of fun to read.
Great.
Well, thank you for being on Pathways today. It was a pleasure.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, Paul.
And we have run out of time. So for those who may have tuned in late, this is Paul O'Brien, and today we've been talking with Jeff Mapes, author of the book The Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. I want to say thank you to our listeners for tuning into Pathways today. The program is made possible in part by a grant from the Divination Foundation, information at divination.com. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to again and share with others by sending them the link, are freely available on the internet at either divination.com or kboo.fm. This is your host, Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways and its podcasts, the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. Until the next show, here's wishing you a fresh start, full of learning, loving, healing, and happiness.